This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, November 16, 2012. In Kansas City, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up, as the death toll rises in Gaza, family members grieve the loss of loved ones. We hear from the family of a BBC producer who lost his 11-month-old son. Israel launches an unprecedented social media campaign promoting its attacks on Gaza. And in Mexico, family members of thousands of people who have disappeared are demanding answers ahead of the new president taking office next month. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Activists all over the world have mobilized to protest Israel's current military campaign against Hamas in Gaza. The escalation in fighting started Wednesday when an Israeli drone strike killed a top Hamas official. The elected leaders of Gaza then retaliated with rocket fire into Israel. The fighting has continued since, despite an attempt at a brief and failed ceasefire today as Egypt's prime minister visited the Gaza Strip. Anti-Israel protesters were out in Egypt, Malaysia, the UK, Iran, Canada, and the US, among other places. A pro-Israel demonstration in London has also been reported. In the West Bank, anti-Israel sentiment is high. FSRN's Ghassan Benor reports that West Bank protests were met by Israeli soldiers, yielding several injuries.
This afternoon, the weekly anti-border wall protests, organized in a number of West Bank villages, shifted focus to the military action in the Gaza Strip. Israeli soldiers confronted the nonviolent demonstrations using tear gas and rubber bullets. 6 Palestinian civilians were injured, 3 from the village of Al-Nabi Saleh in central West Bank. Mohammed Al-Tamimi was there.
Today we were subjected to attacks by soldiers who rained down on us from all directions in order to suppress our protest. They also attacked our homes and children.
Meanwhile, clashes erupted in Bethlehem, southern West Bank, and Ramallah, central West Bank, where hundreds gathered waving flags and chanting anti-Israeli slogans. At a demonstration in Jerusalem, Israeli troops made several arrests. Ghassan Bannoura, FSRN, Bethlehem.
A fire on an oil platform off the Louisiana coast in the Gulf of Mexico today left several people critically injured. 2 men are reported missing. The rig, located about 25 miles offshore, is owned by Houston-based Black Elk Energy, who issued a brief message on their website saying their thoughts and prayers are with those impacted. The platform was reportedly not actively pumping oil at the time of the explosion, although an oil sheen has been reported up to a half mile away. Government environmental inspectors are traveling to the site. Activists working to stop mountaintop removal coal mining in southern Appalachia scored a victory when a company announced that it will end the practice. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
Patriot Coal Corporation came to its decision as part of a settlement with 3 environmental groups over high levels of selenium found in several of its mines. In a settlement publicized Thursday, the Missouri-based company acknowledged the significant impact of its mining operations on local communities. Bo Webb is the coordinator of the Appalachian Community Health Emergency, or AHCE Act, campaign. The proposed law calls for ending surface mining due to serious documented health impacts for local residents, such as elevated cancer rates and birth defects. He said this is a positive development.
Finally, a coal company has acknowledged the peer-reviewed scientific research connecting mountaintop removal to health disparities in mountaintop removal communities.
Patriot's decision to phase out mountaintop removal comes as the company struggles with bankruptcy. Webb says more must be done to shut down mountaintop removal sites owned by other coal companies in Appalachia. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN.
A divided Sixth Circuit Court panel ruled yesterday that banning affirmative action violates minority rights to equal protection under the Constitution. The case focused on college admissions in Michigan. The judges said a state ban puts in place a structural imbalance. A student who wants a policy allowing officials to consider family alumni connections in the admissions process has several ways to pursue that goal. But under the state ban, students wanting a race-conscious admissions policy have only one avenue, changing the state constitution. The Supreme Court is expected to rule on another affirmative action case next year. Supporters of a group of Seattle grand jury resistors have declared this week an International Week of Solidarity for the Northwest activists jailed for not cooperating with federal investigations. Two are still being held at a federal prison in SeaTac, Washington. Vigils and protests are planned this weekend. FSRN's Mark Taylor Canfield reports from Seattle.
Portland, Oregon resident Matt Duran has been held in federal custody since August 5th when he refused to testify before a grand jury investigating the activities of activists in Seattle, Portland, and Olympia. Catherine Olgenick from Olympia has been in detention since September. Portland resident Leland Plant was released from federal custody on October 17th, but neither Plant nor the U.S. attorney involved have discussed publicly the terms of her release. A fourth subpoenaed activist has stated he will also refuse to testify. Maddie Pfeiffer says he expects to be jailed for civil contempt on December 14th when the grand jury reconvenes in Seattle. He was ordered to appear before the grand jury earlier this month, but Pfeiffer's attorney asked for a delay. On Sunday, supporters of the grand jury resistors plan to gather at the federal prison in SeaTac for a day of vigils and protests. Mark Taylor Canfield, Free Speech Radio News, Seattle.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in Kansas City. Israeli airstrikes on Gaza and rocket fire into Israel continue for the third day in a row, and many are concerned about troops being sent into the occupied territory. Israel approved an expansion of the draft to 75,000 troops, and one general addressing soldiers said they were on the eve of a possible ground operation. Armed factions in Gaza launched a rocket that landed in an open area south of Jerusalem, reportedly the first such incident in more than three decades. As of this afternoon, 28 Palestinians have been killed, including children and babies. Hamas rocket fire killed three Israeli civilians on Thursday. At least 200 Gazans have been wounded. And according to Haaretz, the Israeli military has hit more than 500 targets in Gaza. Photos of the attacks show plumes of smoke rising high in the air and charred, demolished buildings. One of the buildings hit this week was the home of a Gazan family. That strike killed an 11-month-old baby and a recently married sister-in-law. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari visited the grieving family and files this report.
Omar Jihad Al-Mashrawi was an 11-month baby from the Zaytun neighborhood in southern Gaza City. An Israeli airstrike on his home killed Omar instantly. He was the son of BBC producer Jihad Al-Mashrawi, whose sister-in-law was also killed. Another family member, Omar's uncle, was severely burned. The strike came right after Israel's assassination of Hamas's military leader Ahmed al-Jabari. Family members and witnesses say a big mass of fire landed on the family's roof, igniting the home and burning the people inside. Ahlam al-Mashrawi is the mother of the killed baby Omar.
We already have a son called Ali. When he was 3 years old, he started to complain that he lacks a brother to play with. Then Jihad and I agreed to have one more baby. Omar came to life, but we didn't imagine he wouldn't grow up, and he is now dead.
Along with the killed baby, Jihad al-Mashrawi's sister-in-law, 20-year-old Hiba al-Turk, was also burnt to death from the Israeli attack. Jihad says that his brother Ahmed is now laying in ICU, suffering from burns over 70% of his body. Om Jihad is the grandmother of Omar.
He used to be with me all the time. I used to put him on my leg to let him sleep, and I used to sing for him until he falls asleep.
Om Jihad cries and sings, "Sleep, my dear, sleep. And if you sleep, I will serve you some good dove dish." Since Wednesday, Israeli attacks on Gaza have killed a number of children, including a 10-month-old baby girl and a 7-year-old girl. One more child was killed earlier on Friday in northern Gaza, and 7 others were injured, mostly children. Rami Al-Maghari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
In Washington, some elected officials are expressing strong support for Israel's airstrikes on Gaza. The President, State Department and Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi all say Israel's current use of aircraft and drones, paid for by US tax dollars, is justified self-defense. But others, including progressive lawmakers and international law experts, say the US response is undermining peace in the region. And as human rights groups investigate the US targeted killing program, they say it sets a dangerous precedent for other countries, including Israel. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
At the first ever congressional briefing on the administration's use of drones for targeted killings overseas, legal and human rights experts raised concerns about the international impact of airstrikes carried out by the U.S. in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. Professor James Cavallaro with Stanford Law School's International Human Rights Clinic.
The actions that the United States has taken are pushing the development of international law in a direction that facilitates the use of drones in countries in which states are not engaged in officially declared war. Since there are now 75 or 76 states that have drones, many of which are trying to weaponize those drones. We've seen drone usage recently, for instance, in the conflict between Israel and Palestine. So the legal paradigm that exists now and that is developing is shaped by what the United States is doing. And I suggest that it's being shaped in ways that are dangerous for global security.
Cavallaro, who recently traveled to Pakistan to investigate the impact of drones on the civilian population, said the U.S. public must demand more transparency and accountability for the drone killings, as some may be war crimes. Outgoing Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich, who organized Friday's briefing, said President Obama violates the War Powers Article of the Constitution and international law with every drone strike, which may lead to other nations following suit.
If we have licensed the wholesale use of drones in other countries, other nations look at that and they say, you know, well, the U.S. is doing it and they sure aren't in any position to complain if we do it. So the whole thing is to understand the impact of our actions.
Most of the estimated 75 countries who have drone technology use it for surveillance. But a handful of nations, including Israel, join the U.S. in using weaponized drones in official and unofficial military conflicts. Israel has been using drones itself for many decades, including during the current wave of strikes on Gaza, and also exports them to other nations. And like the U.S., Israel also carries out targeted killings. The event that started the recent escalation in violence was on Wednesday, when Israel targeted the vehicle of a Hamas military leader with a missile strike, blowing up the car and killing him and his escort. As civilian deaths in Palestine and Israel increased this week, House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi and other U.S. officials publicly voiced their support for Israel's government and military.
Israel has a right to defend itself as a nation, and we are also concerned about any civilian deaths. We mourn those deaths, and we want Hamas not to put people in harm's way, so that we can avoid the loss of civilian life.
In a statement this week, the U.S. State Department called the rockets fired from Gaza cowardly and said they had, quote, no justification. Kucinich, a longtime critic of U.S. military aid to Israel and other nations, said this response is consistent with official U.S. policy, but that policy isn't what's best for the region.
Palestinians and the Israelis are our brothers and sisters. When our brothers and sisters are killing each other, it's up to us to find a way they can reconcile and live together in peace. It's not up to us to take the side of one against another so the killing can continue. We say that we're Israel's friends. Well, friends don't let their friends continually wage war without saying, hey, does this serve your long-term objective of the security of the people of Israel?
On Thursday night, local activists rallied in support of Gaza in front of the White House and said they plan to hold more demonstrations in the coming days. They called on President Obama to stop giving Israel billions of tax dollars in military aid each year. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Since Wednesday, both Israel and Hamas have been using social media in an online propaganda war to rally support for their attacks. Within minutes of the assassination of Hamas military leader Ahmed al-Jabari, the Israeli military posted to Twitter that they'd killed him. Shortly after, they distributed a video of the airstrike on al-Jabari's vehicle. The social media war has continued with aggressive images, graphics, and text posted to multiple platforms. To discuss this new use of social media and its impacts, we're joined by Noah Schachtman, contributing editor at Wired Magazine's national security blog, Danger Room. He's reported from Afghanistan, Israel, and Iraq. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give some examples of what the Israeli government and Hamas are putting up on Twitter and YouTube, and how is this different to what's come before, for instance, that televised bombing of Iraq shown in the U.S. since the first Gulf War?
You know, obviously militaries, since time began, have been trying to use the media, whatever it happens to be, to shape public opinion. And militaries have been using social media for a number of years to accomplish the same ends. What's different about this time is the speed and the aggressiveness that both Israel and Hamas are using social media with. So Israel, in effect, announced the campaign in Gaza with a tweet when it went after and took out the leader of Hamas's military wing. It instantly posted the video of the airstrike to YouTube. This is stuff we hadn't seen before.
Can you take us through exactly how the Israeli government used the social media? So basically, as soon as they'd assassinated Ahmad al-Jabari on Wednesday, it was up there for all to see.
Yeah, a couple hours afterwards. And that's highly unusual. For example, when the American military in Afghanistan goes after, a target in Afghanistan, if there's any documentary evidence of the raid, it's not posted till hours or days or weeks later. This is something quite different.
What sort of response have you been seeing internationally to this new online propaganda war?
To put it in political terms, this is a way to rally one's base, not to sway undecided members of the public. So in other words, if you're already predisposed to taking the Israeli side on this, this is a way really to solidify that support. If you're kind of on the fence, I don't think a tweet or a YouTube video is really going to change your mind very much.
As you've mentioned, you say this is one of the most aggressive social media offensives ever launched by any military. What exactly do you think makes it so aggressive?
I think there's both the speed at which, seemingly every airstrike, every rocket barrage is being tweeted and live blogged on both sides. And also there is an aggressive tone to both sides tweeting, not just sort of reporting what's going on, but kind of taunting the other side, which I find remarkable. I also find it remarkable that on the Hamas side, they're bragging about shooting rockets at Jerusalem, which is one of the holiest cities in all of Islam. It's kind of strange for an Islamic group to be boasting about shelling an Islamic holy city.
You've already mentioned that you think the rationale behind this is to rally the base, but why else do you think Israel's adopting what you describe as a very different way of waging the war of opinion online?
There's a couple of other things. First of all, there's an election coming up in Israel in January, and I think this can only, they're trying to reinforce support for Netanyahu. Secondly, I think it's meant as kind of a warning to the other side not to mess with them. I think it's serving multiple purposes.
Noah Schachtman, contributing editor at Wired Magazine and non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution, thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks for having me.
Join us on Free Speech Radio News Thursday, November 22nd, for a special documentary. Hundreds of Indigenous women and girls have been murdered or have gone missing in Canada over the past 3 decades. In this special documentary, FSRN reporter Tanya Castle looks behind the numbers at the lives affected and the calls to end the violence.
It has been said over and over, if these were white women, that they would have been out looking for them in droves, and that is true. And they really dropped the ball when it came to these women.
Join us this Thursday, November 22nd, for Silenced Sisters, Canada's Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, a special Thanksgiving Day documentary here on FSRN.
In Mexico, cases of missing and disappeared persons have reached crisis levels. During the administration of President Felipe Calderón, who assumed office in 2006, thousands of Mexicans have vanished without a trace. And some families are trying to make sure the issue isn't lost in the upcoming presidential transition. Shannon Young reports.
No one knows for sure just how many people have disappeared during the six-year administration of President Felipe Calderón. But data published this week does provide a hint. At least 14,000 cases were documented between January 2008 and December 2011. That's according to the national newspaper Excelsior. But the number is likely much higher because not all states handed over complete data, and no cases from 2007 or 2012 were included. The most commonly cited independent figure estimates around 30,000 people have disappeared or gone missing in the past 6 years. Many relatives of the disappeared have grown frustrated with the lack of government action. On Monday, a speech by President Calderón to inaugurate a highway was interrupted by Edith Pérez, whose two sons were abducted August 14th, along with her brother, a nephew, and a niece near Ciudad Mante, in the border state of Tamaulipas. Pérez said the family has gone to all agencies possible without any concrete results. Pérez's sister, Graciela, whose 13-year-old only daughter is among the missing, says she keeps a list of reports of shootouts and homicides in the area. Despite written and in-person requests, Tamaulipas state officials have yet to provide details or photographs of bodies that would allow her to eliminate the doubt that her relatives may be among the dead.
La idea de la familia es que siguen vivos, pero...
We want to believe they're still alive, but we can't be sure. But hope dies last. So I've filed written requests with the authorities and hope from the bottom of my heart that they at least respond. Given they aren't searching, they can at least look at what they do have.
The state of Tamaulipas is infamous for its lack of transparency. Infiltration of government and police institutions by organized crime is an open secret. But families looking for abducted relatives in other states have also complained of systematic runaround treatment.
La primera reacción de las autoridades.
Jorge Verástegui is a university student whose brother and nephew were abducted in 2009 in the state of Coahuila. He's a member of FUNDEC, an association of relatives of the disappeared, which has met on multiple occasions with state and federal officials to push for search mechanisms and legal protocols. Verástegui says the first reaction by authorities is to criminalize the victims and intimidate those who speak out. When the issue becomes too big to ignore, Verástegui says officials make some concessions without openly recognizing the magnitude of the problem. Jurisdictional ambiguities have also allowed officials to pass the buck between the federal and state levels, especially when it comes to naming the crime. For example, an armed abduction that does not come with a subsequent ransom demand won't necessarily be categorized as a kidnapping, which is a federal crime.
Mi hermano y mi mamá van a poner la denuncia a la PGR.
Maricela Reyes Salazar says that when three of her relatives were taken by armed men near Ciudad Juarez in 2011, federal investigators refused to register the crime as a forced disappearance and made the family file the complaint as a missing persons case. This tendency prompted family associations like FUNDEC to push for states to recognize the crime of forced disappearance. Just this week, the state legislature of Nuevo León approved a measure to recognize forced disappearance as a crime. It was the third state to do so this year. Relatives also say federal and state governments need to show more political will when it comes to searching for the disappeared, dead or alive. When illegal mass graves are discovered, the investigations are often handled by state authorities. There's no centralized federal database to store DNA samples of those seeking missing or disappeared relatives, despite recommendations made to Mexico by the United Nations Working Group on Enforced or Involuntary Disappearances. Murder victims whose bodies medical examiners are unable to identify go into state mass graves. A recent investigation by Milenio found more than 24,000 unidentified bodies have been sent to cemetery mass graves during the present administration. Maricela Reyes and her family staged a hunger strike and an attention-grabbing sit-in protest until the bodies of their three abducted relatives appeared. Under pressure, the state government of Chihuahua offered a reward for information on the whereabouts of the family. Their bodies were left near a roadside soon after. But Reyes says the agony of not knowing the fate of a loved one is far worse than having to bury the dead.
In our case, they had to unbury our dead so we could have them. Perhaps it was just so we'd shut our mouths, but we got them. So I want people to know that if you fight, you can win. That, thank God, we found them and we know where they are. And that if one day we can go back to Juarez Valley, we know they're there and we can at least bring them a flower.
Other relatives of missing persons recently held a week-long hunger strike in front of the Interior Ministry. They warned they're prepared to return if the government doesn't make good on promises of concrete actions in their cases. The hunger strike was part of an effort to keep the issue of the disappeared on the government's agenda ahead of the December 1st change of administrations. Other relatives and supporters have been hard at work for months embroidering the stories of victims on white handkerchiefs. Among them is Jorge Verástegui, who participated in the public sewing circles known as Embroidery for Peace in the northern city of Monterrey.
We know it's only a symbolic act, but there's something about embroidering the stories that gives us a certain sense of calm. It's like a way to let off steam, to provide an outlet for all of this pain that's been building up in us over the past few years.
The Embroidery for Peace groups plan to stitch together their work to present in Mexico City's main plaza the day Enrique Peña Nieto takes office as president, a visual reminder of the debt of justice owed to thousands of families and of a crisis that has been steadily building over the past 6 years. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
And that's it for today's program and for the week. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Puck Lowe. Headlines editor, Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In Kansas City, standing in for Dorian Marina, I'm Danny Wood.